Hello, and welcome to Science World. Bob Doty tells us that technicians and engineers working on the world's most powerful atom smasher ran into a bit of a snag this past week, which could delay its restart after a two-year hiatus. A new observatory in Mexico that could help scientists learn more about black holes and supernovas was formally inaugurated and put into full operation recently. Philip Alexio will have that story. And artificial lighting can often act as virtual light magnets, attracting a variety of disease-carrying insects that can threaten human health. We'll talk with the leader of a research team who have found that light bulbs can be customized so that they won't attract these potentially dangerous insects. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. The European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, ran into a bit of a snag this week with its plans to get its giant Large Hadron Collider, or LHC, back up and running after a two-year hiatus. Science World's Bob Doty tells us more.
CERN officials said this week that the delay in getting the particle accelerator fully operational could be anywhere from a few days to several weeks, but they're confident that the impact on operation of the Large Hadron Collider will be minimal. Operators of the giant atom smasher spotted an intermittent short circuit to ground on March 21st within one of the machine's eight sectors and are investigating the problem. The other seven sectors of the LHC, according to CERN, have already been successfully commissioned for operation. While the engineers and technicians, working to get the Large Hadron Collider back online after being shut down for 2 years, understand the problem, CERN said it still might take a bit of time to get the machine back online. Even when the necessary repairs are made, the malfunctioning LHC sector may need to be warmed up first and then cooled down again before operators can resume the lengthy process of bringing the Large Particle Accelerator online. Once the machine is up and running, CERN said LHC operators and the science teams who use it for research will take the rest of 2015 to learn more about the upgraded machine and how it performs. Full-scale physics experiments with the Large Hadron Collider are expected to resume and run from 2016 to 2018. Since its first beam was fired in 2008, work conducted with CERN's Large Hadron Collider has attracted a lot of attention from physicists around the world. Scientists searching for the mysterious and elusive Higgs boson announced on July 4, 2012, that they had discovered a new particle that could be just what they are looking for. The Higgs boson is a theoretical elementary particle that has been put forward by the Standard Model of Particle Physics. The standard model details just how the rudimentary building blocks of matter interact with the four fundamental forces of nature, which are gravitational, electromagnetic, strong nuclear, and weak nuclear. During its downtime, the giant particle accelerator was upgraded by CERN to run with almost double the energy of its first run. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
A new study finds that the parasite that causes malaria also produces an odor which attracts mosquitoes, inviting even more bites and infections. Jessica Berman reports.
The finding that chemical compounds called terpenes give off odors that mosquitoes find inviting could help break the cycle of malaria transmission by leading to a quick, non-invasive test for the disease, which now involves taking a blood sample and looking for evidence of the parasite. The scent of terpenes is emitted in the breath and sweat of infected individuals. Audrey Odom is a pediatrician and microbiologist at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri. She said her team's work documented that the type of mosquitoes that transmit malaria are able to detect the specific compounds produced by the parasites, an ability that guides the insects to infect people, increasing the chances the disease will spread.
Do they really do what we think they're doing in terms of promoting malaria transmission? And so we're doing studies to try to identify what proteins in the malaria parasite produce these compounds.
Odom and her colleagues are planning to conduct a clinical trial in Malawi involving children with uncomplicated malaria to see whether researchers can detect the presence of terpenes in the youngster's breath and sweat. The measurements will be compared to hospitalized children who do not have malaria. If the theory holds up, the parasites that infect human blood cells give off a scent that's attractive to mosquitoes. Investigators could develop methods for breaking the infection cycle with mosquito traps.
Other people have already started to try what's called attractive sugar baiting. So essentially making traps for mosquitoes that use the kind of compounds that they're attracted to. So the mosquitoes fly to the traps excited by the smells that they smell, and then they get poisoned there.
The study on terpenes is published in the journal MBio. The World Health Organization reports malaria infects an estimated 2 million people every year, resulting in almost 600,000 deaths, most of them children under the age of 5. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Science World's Philip Alexio tells us about a powerful new observatory in Mexico that just might help scientists unlock some of the biggest mysteries of the cosmos.
The High-Altitude Water Cherenkov Experiment, or HAWC, one of the largest and most powerful observatories ever built on Earth, was recently inaugurated and put into full operation. To many, the observatory at first glance looks like a water treatment plant. Instead, this complex of structures built at the foot of Mexico's Sierra Negra volcano can detect high-energy cosmic particles that zoom past and into the Earth from the far reaches of the universe. Researchers are hoping that this new gamma-ray detecting facility, which took 4 years to construct, will help them untangle the mysteries of such celestial phenomena as black holes and supernovas. Officials of the High-Altitude Water Cherenkov Experiment said that their observatory will be able to detect and track where gamma rays originated, no matter how many light years away. The HAWC Observatory includes an array of 50,000-gallon tanks filled with pure water. At the bottom of each of the tanks is a special detector that can measure the angle and intensity of a blast of these highly charged particles as they smash their way in at a velocity that's faster than the speed of light. Dr. Jordan Goodman from the University of Maryland and a physicist at HAWC spoke with Reuters about this new cosmic ray detector.
We've been interested for a long time in gamma rays. They're a messenger to point back into space differently. Gamma rays, of course, point go straight. They're light. But they're the highest energy light, so they let us understand where the highest energy particles in the universe come from. So our idea is to build this observatory to give us a wide field view of the sky at the highest energies.
Goodman said that the new HAWC facility will be able to cover about two-thirds of the sky within one 24-hour period, thanks to the size of the observatory and the Earth's rotation. Scientists involved with the High-Altitude Water Cherenkov Experiment are hoping that by locating and mapping just where these gamma rays are coming from, they'll be able to learn more about the massive cosmic events that produce them. I'm Philip Alexio for Science World.
As you heard earlier, CERN ran into a little trouble recently with efforts to restart their giant atom smasher, the Large Hadron Collider. For the LHC to be built, CERN had to first dismantle another large particle accelerator that had been used from 1989 to 2000. For this week's Science World Quick Quiz, we'd like to know the name of that particle accelerator. Was it A, the Large Electron Positron Collider, B, the Tevatron, or C, the Cosmotron? Think about it. We'll have the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
The Last Man on the Moon is a documentary that tells the story of the last human being to stand on the surface of the moon over 40 years ago, U.S. astronaut Eugene Cernan. Greg Flakus tells us that Cernan advocates a more vigorous space program.
In 1972, Captain Eugene Cernan and two fellow astronauts began what would become the last mission to the moon, Apollo 17. On December 14, 1972, after scratching his daughter's initials in the lunar dust and setting up a remote camera, he stepped into the lunar lander and left the moon. Cernan assumed someone else would go back, but then he says the U.S. space program took a wrong turn.
Oh, there is no space program.
He's disappointed by the current situation.
We can't even put an American in space, on a made-in-American piece of hardware, to go to our own space station.
Cernan came to Austin to promote the film about him, aptly called The Last Man on the Moon. The film tells of a time in the 1960s and early 1970s when the United States was launching men into space every few months. It mixes archival footage of a young Cernan with shots of the older man of today revisiting sites associated with his space adventure. There's triumph, but also sadness, as Cernan recalls the cost his family paid for his all-out commitment to his career. Director Mark Craig says it was not hard getting frank, honest comments from Cernan.
Luckily for us, Gene is a very articulate character anyway, and so he was able to sort of express his own feelings and emotions.
It's clear that Cernan remains fascinated by the moon.
Would I go back in a half a second?
Cernan knows his days in space are over, but he hopes others will follow up on what he and his fellow astronauts started.
All we got to do is inspire those young kids and give them the opportunity that someone gave myself and all my colleagues.
And what does it take to be a space explorer?
If you believe that what you're doing throughout life is the right thing to do, and you're willing to accept a challenge and take the risk to get it done, you've got what I call the right stuff.
And he hopes the film, The Last Man on the Moon, helps spread that message. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Austin, Texas.
The recent discovery of a variety of heat-resistant beans is promising to save the humble bean from devastation in the face of climate change. Hillary Hewler has more from Nairobi.
For centuries, beans have been a crucial food for hundreds of millions of people around the world. In Africa and Latin America, they're a staple crop and sometimes a community's only reliable source of protein. But researchers say with global temperatures expected to rise by up to 4 degrees in coming years, the bean could be at risk. A bean researcher for food security group CGIAR, Steve Beebe, says because beans originated in a relatively cool climate, the effects of global warming could be devastating.
Beans are going to be under a lot of heat stress in the future. If we're not careful, we calculate that within a generation, if we don't get moving, we could lose as much as 50% of the bean area around the world.
Beans are more vulnerable to higher temperatures than other staple crops like cassava and maize, he says. But on Wednesday, CGIAR announced that it had discovered a new variety of heat-resistant bean that can handle temperatures several degrees higher than normal beans. A cross with the tepary bean, a small variety once grown by Native Americans, this new strain of heat-beater beans can handle nighttime temperatures of up to 23 degrees, whereas most bean crops will start to fail at 18 or 19 degrees, says Beebe.
It's a species that's naturally adapted to high temperatures. We had some interspecific crosses sitting on the shelf, and when we started realizing what we're up against with rising temperatures, we pulled them off the shelf. That's where we found most of the really promising heat tolerance that we're working into the breeding program pretty much across the board.
The next step, he says, is to introduce heat tolerance into a range of beans already familiar to consumers, then to distribute them to partners in Africa and Latin America. CGIAR is also trying to breed bean varieties that would be more tolerant of drought or flooding, as well as working to boost their iron content to make them more nutritious. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
People cured of pulmonary tuberculosis often continue to have problems breathing, while poor living conditions contribute to their continued suffering. But a contribution by a group of European doctors may soon help millions of former TB patients. George Putich has more.
The World Health Organization says tuberculosis, or TB, is the greatest killer in the world, second only to AIDS. In 2013, 1.5 million people died of the 9 million who fell ill with TB, mostly in low and middle income countries such as Uganda. Those who recover often continue to suffer from a chronic cough that makes it increasingly harder to breathe, says Dr. Wenceslaus Katagira from Kampala's Mulago Hospital.
After TB is treated, the destruction of the lungs doesn't reverse. So it stays, and when it stays, that will heal by scar formation. And among the so many things that will cause a chronic lung disease is the scar tissue that remains in the lungs.
Aggravating the situation are open fires many families use for cooking, kerosene lighting, and tobacco smoke, which all release microscopic particles that contribute to chronic bronchitis and emphysema for recovering TB patients. Their condition worsens to the point where they become unable to work. A pulmonary rehabilitation program established at Mulago Hospital showed that patients' health substantially improves when they attend exercise classes and improve their nutrition.
They come back 12 weeks after, they've put on weight, they're all light, they have very bright smiles, and they can do all these things yet again. They are telling you, well, now I can look after my grandchildren.
Patient Naki Goasia says she feels much better than before.
I was too weak when I used medicine, doesn't work. When I started exercises, I started getting that energy. But at that time when I came, I was too sick when I got blood, much blood.
Study leader Dr. Rupert Jones from the Peninsular School of Medicine and Dentistry says the results gathered in Uganda may benefit other countries with large numbers of TB patients.
We're going to be producing manuals, and hopefully, if we get the ongoing funding, we're going to be taking this out across East Africa and to other countries across Europe and the Far East as well.
After the initial study at Mulago Hospital, the group plans to start a larger program in May. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. For the Large Hadron Collider to be built, CERN had to first dismantle another large particle accelerator that had been in use from 1989 to 2000. For this week's Science World Quick Quiz, we wanted to know the name of that particle accelerator. Was it A, the Large Electron Positron Collider, B, the Tevatron, or C, the Cosmotron? Well, while all the answer choices are actually names used for various particle accelerators, the answer we were looking for is A, the Large Electron Positron Collider. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
The artificial illumination that lights up our nights can also be virtual magnets that can attract a variety of disease-carrying insects into our homes. This can be especially dangerous to people living in developing nations where vector-borne illnesses such as malaria, dengue, and Chagas disease have had such a serious impact on public health. Researchers led by Professor Travis Longcore at the University of Southern California have found that LED light bulbs can be customized to provide illumination that is less attractive to different insect species, especially those that bring disease. Professor Longcore joins us for this week's one-on-one segment to tell us about his research and findings.
For outdoor lighting, know already that some types of lamps represent areas of the visual spectrum, the colors of the light, that do attract more insects. So, for example, light that has blue or violet or ultraviolet that we can't even see as humans is very attractive to moths. That's the reason that you can get bug lights from the hardware store that are yellow, and it has very yellow lights have very little blue in them. There are wide differences, and they're based on things that we do know already about the behavior of insects.
Speaking of insects, we're talking about insects that carry vector-borne diseases. What are we talking about? What kind of insects are we talking about, and what kind of diseases do they carry?
We'd be talking about things like mosquitoes that carry malaria, kissing bugs, sand flies, all of which carry diseases like Chagas disease and leishmaniasis. And so these are all tropical, endemic tropical diseases that have insects that are the vectors that get the disease to people. The research on the connection between lighting and outbreaks of these insects is relatively new but solid. It's strongest for Chagas and leishmaniasis, and the evidence is also there that mosquitoes are attracted to lights too, and so it stands to reason that that is part of the role that lighting would play a role in exposure to mosquitoes as well.
So in other words, people in these countries where these insects tend to populate are becoming more susceptible to some of these diseases then?
That's exactly the premise of the research that we've been undertaking. And the reason that indoor light is the focus here is because people tend to like to have indoor lights that they can see colors with, what we would call a full spectrum light, a white light. And what our research is trying to do is to identify ways to adjust the white light so that it looks the same but attracts fewer insects.
Does the brightness of the light matter in attracting or distracting these insects?
Yeah, brightness does matter. So we're comparing lights that are relatively close in brightness. But one thing to remember is that there's a huge range of brightness that goes on between the middle of the day and what we have maybe for a light at night. So even something that might be quote-unquote twice as bright, the spectrum is actually more important than the brightness for that. But if we were talking about orders of magnitude brighter, then that brightness is going to be more important than the spectrum. And that was an interesting result that came out of our research, is that the brightness wasn't, and even though we had some variation in the brightness of the lamps that we used in the experiment, that brightness wasn't as important as the spectrum, the makeup of the light itself.
It was also suggested that you could go about perhaps fine-tuning these light bulbs so that they won't attract disease-carrying insects or affect humans in such a disrupting way. How would you go about doing that?
What we did is basically a proof of concept that you can use tunable LED bulbs, so light-emitting diodes, LEDs, which are very energy efficient, to create the appearance of, say, an incandescent bulb, 2700 Kelvin color temperature, with a combination of wavelengths that reduces the attractiveness to insects but still gives us what we need from the human eye to perceive it as being white light and usable for indoor use. The way in which LEDs here differ from other lamp types is that we can do this fine-tuning of the spectrum. You can't do that with a compact fluorescent bulb. The sort of spectral output is pretty much fixed, and the only way you can adjust it is through putting filters on it. Here we're not using filters. We're using different colored LEDs, different diode colors, red, blue, green, and white, to mix together to create something that looks white that would be very suitable in terms of color rendering and vision for indoor use, and yet has less output in the areas of the spectrum that insects are going to respond to. And we calculated that by taking the two insect response curves, which are published already for moths and for honeybees, and calculated how much the output of the different configurations that we had available from our collaborator Philips research. They produce these customizable LEDs to be able to pick the configurations that had the color temperature we wanted, the visual look that we wanted, but minimize the outputs in the areas of the spectrum that were most sensitive to insects. And then we compared those to an off-the-shelf LED and off-the-shelf compact fluorescent bulbs.
That was Professor Travis Longcore at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more, so stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.